TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Professor Rupert Reed, The End of Globalization and the Return of Localization. How Climate Change Breakdown Terminates the Concept of Development. When Rupert Reed first appeared on TUC Radio with his talk, "This Civilization is Finished, So What is to Be Done?" he drew a huge response. He is a professor and well-established intellectual who risks arrest in his association with the Extinction Rebellion movement in England. XR used civil disobedience to make governments, and really everyone, declare climate change emergencies and act on them. It is still new and unusual for academics to be activists. In the archives of TUC Radio are academics who were threatened with denial of tenure if they spoke out against the war in Vietnam or genetic engineering, nuclear power, or even warned of climate change. And you will hear in a moment that even in September 2019, Professor Rupert Reed, in front of an academic audience at the prestigious University College London, feels compelled to say, "I come here with a message many of you will find hard not to resist." But as the urgency grows to deal with climate change, academia is changing. Rupert Reed was chosen to give a prestigious lecture, and he's welcomed as friend and colleague by Professor Brad Blitz. Here's some of what Blitz said in his introduction.
Good morning. We're absolutely delighted to sponsor this event and indeed to introduce Rupert Reed. Rupert is known to many of you. He's been a spokesperson for Extinction Rebellion and a most articulate one as well. He is also a philosopher and a public intellectual and the author of these two new books, This Civilization is Finished and Facing Up to Climate Reality, Honesty, Dishonesty, and Hope. And these books speak to major debates which we are having within our intellectual communities, but also more broadly, questions about just how far mitigation will take us, if indeed it will, the need for adaptation, and the threat and very real danger of collapse. So with that, I'd like to turn over to Rupert.
Thanks, Brad, and it's a real honor to be here giving this prestigious all-hack lecture. What are my credentials to be giving this lecture? Well, you've already heard one or two things. Let me just add slightly to that. I think of myself as a political philosopher who cut my teeth in that field, radically critiquing on both ecological and social justice grounds the political philosophy of liberal individualism. And as an activist, I've been an activist, well, all my adult life, really. But in the last year, I've become involved with Extinction Rebellion, and, well, it seems to me that the activism I've been involved with over the last year has been more significant than all the activism I've been involved with in the previous 20 or 30 years. We accomplished something really deeply encouraging, I would say to you, in April of this year, especially in this country, with Extinction Rebellion, when in 2 weeks, as we held on to some iconic public spaces in London, we really transformed the public debate and consciousness in this country around ecology and especially around climate. And I think that the extraordinary success of that rebellion in doing that, and the success is measurable in opinion polls if you want to look into it. It's very, very striking, is actually about the most hopeful development, at least in this country and possibly in Europe, for about a generation, really, in terms of the kind of things that we're concerned with in a conference like this one. So yes, as Brad has said, and as I've just reinforced, I come here as a philosopher and as an activist. But I must tell you that in both capacities, I come here with a slight sense of trepidation. For while temperamentally and historically, I'd certainly consider myself, I have no doubt, an ally of most of you in this room, and while I'm encouraged by the ecstatic reception that you gave Vandana Shiva yesterday, because I regard myself as, among other things, a kind of disciple of her work, I come here with a message that many of you will, I think, nevertheless find hard not to resist, to some extent at least. For my philosophy and my activism alike have pushed me to repudiate the very widely hegemonic doctrine of human development, a doctrine associated, among other things, with the very name and ambition of this lecture. So yeah, I come here with a slight sense of trepidation. We'll see whether or not that sense is justified. I should stress that this repudiation that I'm about to make is very much my own. If you don't like it, please don't blame Extinction Rebellion for it. Though, as I say, it does come from my experience both as an activist and as a philosopher. So let me seek to be as succinct as possible, and truthful, perhaps brutally so, for which I've become known over the past few years, as is urgent and is necessary. We've no time left for beating around the bush. So, I don't believe that what is called development is a good objective. We all, I hope, know the awful history of the concept of development, how it originated in the Truman administration as basically a way for countries like the United States to say the whole world ought to be like us, a project of extraordinary arrogance and hubris. Developmentality is a doctrine of European or American supremacy, and I think that should give us deep cause to doubt it. I don't believe that development makes people happy or fulfilled either, and I will return to this consideration. But whether or not I'm right in these stark claims is, in a way, I want to say, irrelevant, for the even more unpalatable truth I want to convey to you this morning is climate and ecological breakdown is going to make development history anyway. Development, in the sense at least of growing economic opportunity about the world, is about to be terminated. We must face up to climate reality, otherwise Earth will terminate us and make us history. And that's why my think tank Greenhouse put together this book, Facing Up to Climate Reality. Really facing up to climate reality changes everything. The story we tell ourselves of a continual increase of the human standard of living is over. Conditions for beings on this planet are without doubt going to decline for at least a generation, probably significant longer, whatever we do, even if we do exactly what Extinction Rebellion is rightly urging us to do. The situation will get much worse still unless we overcome our addiction to development, inasmuch, again, as development translates into industrial growthism. If we think about it in the terms of the Sustainable Development Goals, the 8th Sustainable Development Goal undermines systematically whatever is good in all the other Sustainable Development Goals. We are in an emergency, a long, effectively permanent emergency. It will define increasingly the entirety of the lives of all of us in this hall and all of us in the world. We need, therefore, an emergency break on climate deadly emissions and on habitat destruction. We are heading for collapse. Deadly anthropogenic climate change is not some kind of unexpected black swan event. It is, as I like to put it, a white swan in plain view, heading serenely towards us as we head serenely towards self-destruction. And when I say we here, I mean pretty much all of us internationally. Our systems are so fragile, partly, of course, because they are so globalized, so excessively interconnected. It is going to take an utterly unprecedented, enormous, rapid course correction now to prevent collapse. And to be clear and unambiguous, when I talk about collapse, I mean global collapse making mass death, I mean probably billions, not just millions, very likely. The basic truth of my title, therefore, of my talk, is, I claim, unarguable. Globalization is finished. The future will be far more relocalized. Short, carbon-light, relatively resilient supply lines will define the future. This is fact. The only issue is whether we get there accidentally or on purpose, right? The only issue is whether we get there as a result of collapse or as a result of a rapid, unprecedented, wonderful course correction. And that is what I mean when I say that this civilization is finished. The only way we're going to survive without collapse is if we transform our civilization so rapidly and deeply that it will in no meaningful sense be the same civilization that we currently inhabit. But the inevitable end of globalization and the rebirth of the local could yet be the making of us. It could even be superbly serendipitous if we make it the basis of civilizational transformation. How exactly does the germ of an idea that I've just offered translate into the story of human development? So we have a supposedly developed global north and a developing global south. The usual assumption is that the south will, over time, catch up. And what I'm saying is, quite obviously, it can't. There is no ecological space for it to do so. What I'm saying might therefore seem to make the vast inequality of our world today permanent, and that would, of course, be intolerable. But what if, together, we got off the development treadmill? What if we got off the development drug altogether? What if we all stopped prizing it? What if those of us who've been hooked on the drug the longest went cold turkey? What if we stopped pretending that the story of the last 300 years is a story of linear progress? What if instead of seeking further such progress and development, we instead sought to build down our footprints, to congruify ourselves once more with nature and with our deepest selves? You see, mine is absolutely not a council of despair. The end of developmentality does not have to mean the end of humanity. On the contrary, it could yet lead to things actually getting better, even within the context of the kind of deteriorating climate that is inevitable for the foreseeable future. How so? Well, here we come to what I like to call in a phrase which is the title of my next book, The Beautiful Coincidence. The beautiful coincidence is that the very things we need to do in order to avoid climatic and ecological nemesis are, by and large, the very things we need to do in order to create a world that is more happy, more fulfilled, with more of a sense of meaning. To, for example, end the epidemic of loneliness, which has the entire global north pretty much in its grip. To rebuild community. And of course, we're going to have a reason to struggle, in a struggle not against a scapegoatable enemy, but against the specter of our own self-destruction for a long time to come. Relocalization means livelihoods. It means good, meaningful, secure livelihoods. And you can begin understanding this with things like the local food movement, slow food, and so forth. The things that here in a country like this one, we're just starting painfully to rediscover, having spent centuries systematically obliterating them. We developed countries really are not all that we are cracked up to be. The death of the fantasy of development as something desirable and possible starts here. The beautiful coincidence is that relocalization and a systemic reduction of our ecological footprint is exactly what we need to overcome the deep malaise in which societies like this one are stuck. We can think of something better than the UK or the USA in anything like their current form as our destiny. We can already see that something in embryo in such venues as the transition towns movement, in community-supported agriculture and permaculture and agroforestry, more generally in agroecology, and looking further afield in Via Campesina, and in the way indeed that some Adivasi people are still living, and much more. A question may be forming in some of your minds, those of you unconvinced by the direction of travel of my remarks. You may be thinking that it's very easy for me to sit here or stand here in luxury and lecture the world on how to be. You might be thinking, it's all very well to be saying this from a privileged UK context, but something very important about the UK is that we're miles away from being self-sufficient in terms of food. England is a country that's more densely populated than India. Not many people know that. What's the significance of us being unself-sufficient in food? Well, of course, the significance in terms of the likelihood of coming climate breakdown is that it's quite likely that there'll be a time 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, probably within my lifetime, unless everything changes, where there is a multi-breadbasket failure, which affects not just Britain but many other countries, and where Britain's usual recourse of being able to buy food from around the world suddenly starts to look a lot less easy as multiple countries close their frontiers to food exports, as happened in 2007-08. But it'll happen much worse in that kind of scenario, in a climate-ravaged future which we are moving into. And so we are absolutely not immune in this country to the terrible future that is now looming over us. In fact, we might be one of the worst sufferers from it in times to come. If that element of my answer doesn't satisfy you, though, I've got a couple more. So, secondly, I don't ask you primarily to listen to me, nor even to the wisdom traditions of West and Eastern philosophy that have been my greatest inspirations. But I do ask you to listen to the indigenous peoples and peasant peoples of the world. I do ask you to listen to those indigenous peoples who have been defending a vision of more harmonious ways of living and of prospering for centuries. And the third element of my answer to the question that I posed is, listen to, if you can, to the voice of the earth itself. I'm thinking here of Theodore Rozsák's work. Consider that the mother of all mental health crises is coming, as people around the world wake up to what industrial growth capitalism, aka development, is doing to our security and our posterity. You think that we're already suffering from a mental health epidemic? You're right, but you ain't seen nothing yet. It's going to get far, far worse over the coming decade. But you know, this crisis too could be the making of us. And this is the insight at the heart of the new emerging discipline of eco-psychology, which suggests that when people feel eco-anxiety, they're feeling something which is appropriate and far from being a sign of mental ill health. It's actually, in the big sense of things, a sign of an emerging health, an awakening health. And actually, this is a key reason for the success of Extinction Rebellion. Extinction Rebellion is, among other things, a mode of processing emotions that we've been long trying to hide. Eco-anxiety, terror at our future, horror at what we're doing to the world, deep grief at what's already been lost. These things, when seen correctly, I say again, are not mental ill health. On the contrary. And of course, what underlies them all is love, which Extinction Rebellion also talks about, seeks to unleash. Why do we grieve? Because we love. Extinction Rebellion's first demand is tell the truth. Tell the truth about how bad things are. And what happens if we open ourselves to that demand is we face reality, we emote and resonate appropriately with it and with each other. And then we are ready to act literally, vitally. And then we are the earth coming to a painful consciousness. And of course, my second and third point here are connected. Return to some kind of sense of the sacredness of the earth, maybe a sine qua non for us to find our way out of our awful predicament. Possibly what I've just been saying is too mystical for some of you. If it is, then let me make the point more plainly. There are people who are protecting the earth's remaining viable ecosystems, people who can teach us how to live life more lightly on the earth. I'm not bothered whether you listen to me or not, so long as you listen to them. And as you do so, listen to what the Earth's creaking systems themselves seem to be saying to us. For obviously, one key reason why everything is changing in our consciousness around climate and ecology, and why Extinction Rebellion and the climate school strikes are kicking off and finding vast resonance, is the way we can see in the last 3 years or so our climate spinning out of control in real time. If you still think that I'm lecturing the so-called developing world, then let me say this. All of this really does begin at home. A return to love and to life begins at home in countries like this one. After all, we started the trouble. The Industrial Revolution began not very far away from where I'm standing right now. We have absolutely no leg to stand on if, as well as massive free green tech transfer, we don't lead the way in restoring biodiversity and decarbonizing. At the very least, we need to cut the ground from under the argument that we have no right to want developing countries to use less fossil fuels, given how much we're still using ourselves. We can cut the ground from that argument only by undertaking a dramatic energy descent. We'll never be listened to unless we finally lead a little by following the example of indigenous earth protectors, of Sava Dayan, Swaraj, etc. The transformation, the end of the impossible fantasy of industrial growthism for all forever, begins here and now. And that's why I think it's significant and appropriate that Extinction Rebellion has begun here. And so again, I say, we developed countries are not all we're cracked up to be. That's what the existence of a rebellion against our current way of life recognizes. And I think also here of Helena Norberg Hodge's marvelous reality tours. What Helena Norberg Hodge, the founder of the Local Futures Movement, does in these reality tours is she brings indigenous and peasant people to a country like this one or to the United States, and she shows them the glitzy shopping malls, and she shows them the vast landfills, and she shows them the places where old people are warehoused in countries like this one. She shows them the victims of the opioid epidemic, and so on. She shows them the reality of a country like this. And of course, actually, the reality is much worse. The despoliation of so much of the global south, from the burning rainforest to the desolate cobalt mines, from the vast piles of old fridges that we've exported to China to the vanishing island states, is largely, of course, down to us. Doubly so since the unbelievably stupid export of our most polluting industries to China and India. Thus, the importance of our push in Extinction Rebellion to get the government to tell the real truth about embodied emissions. See, our government goes around posturing in the world and posturing to its citizens saying, oh, look at these amazing emissions reductions figures that we've got in the United Kingdom. And what we say is, you're just lying with statistics, right? When you do the statistics properly, when you include all the crap that we've exported to China and India and so forth, you see that our emissions have barely fallen since 1990. Once you see our true footprint, it's doubly true that we're not all that we're cracked up to be. And one of the best things that people like me can do, I think, is rid the world of the illusion that we're a telos devoutly to be wished. How can we be, this is really the crux of the matter, how can we be developed, complete, adequate, given an adequate, complete rendition of the profound uglinesses and catastrophes at the heart of our way of living? Most pointedly, how can a way of living be a developed way of living if it points directly over the cliff of collapse? This question, I believe, quite obviously has no answer except to say it can't and it isn't. The economic way of life of countries like this one is not something to be aimed at. It is, in fact, shameful and absurd. It is criminal to be part of a way of life that is quite possibly on the way toward extinguishing complex life on Earth. Okay, moving towards a close. Before I finish, let me note in passing that I'm not imposing a new dogma to replace developmentality, a new dogma of relocalization. Rather, I say to you quite simply, it is coming, whether you like it or not. So let's implement it intelligently. What does that mean? So, of course, we need international coordination, in fact, much greater international coordination against threats that know no borders, so most obviously climate. Of course, we need also some networked capacity to respond to disasters, the tide of which will inevitably, as I've already mentioned, rise over the next generation or two. Those disasters, too, by the way, could yet be the making of us. They may hold an enormous silver lining. Rebecca Solnit has written about this in perhaps her most important book, The Paradise is Built in Hell, a book in which she looks at the way in which disasters can be transformative to the communities that experience them, because they obliterate the dysfunctional status quo and force people into a more giving, altruistic, more forward-looking way of being together, and sometimes have quite long-lasting consequences. And there's a chapter on this that I co-authored in Facing Up to Climate Reality. The coming climate disasters, if we're willing to respond to them in the right way, could yet be the making of us. And yes, of course, we need some network capacity to respond to them, not purely locally as well. So, yeah, of course, let's implement a relocalization intelligently. But let's be clear, localization is going to replace globalization as a general direction of travel. And depending on how this is done, the development industry will either yield to collapse or to a new sense of community, living together much more likely on the earth, to the transformation of the status quo, a transformation that voices in the global south have been calling for, which Extinction Rebellion joins in countries like this one in calling for. In the future, I'm imagining we'll be living on much less and in adversity, but I claim likely to be happier in the process, as we were, by the way, in World War II, when, of course, in this country, the country became far more equal, suicide rates dropped, and basically it became a happier place to be despite the extreme adversity which people were suffering under. So I hope to be part of building this community with you in a quasi-wartime mobilization which we're going to need permanently if we're going to escape from a terrible collapse event. This new old political philosophy, which offers us even now the splendid chance of an ancient future, is being prefigured right now in a small way in, for example, the beautiful actions of Extinction Rebellion, which I had the great privilege, for instance, to be a part of when we transformed Waterloo Bridge this April, for example, into a garden and into a skate park. I hope that you will join us so that this ancient future will take root and flourish. Friends, the darkest hour really is just before the dawn. Perhaps April of this year was a first ray of light of that dawn. Thank you for your time and attention. Thank you.
That was Professor Rupert Reed. He spoke on the end of globalization and the return of localization at the prestigious University College London on September 10, 2019. Rupert Reed is teaching philosophy at the University of East Anglia. He's a longtime Green Party politician. In October 2018, Reed declared himself a supporter of Extinction Rebellion, an environmental direct action group. And he became a signatory of the open letter published in The Guardian. Vandana Shiva, Naomi Klein, Noam Chomsky, Bill McKibben, and many more also signed on to that letter. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.